dari
welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is April 5th, 2011, and this is episode 502. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't always make the mainstream news, the kinds of things that are frequently labeled as alternative or paranormal. For the show tonight, if you would like to have a question asked, you can email me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. Send it through the virtual auditorium on Pal Talk by text is another option. I do monitor the email during the program, and if you're listening outside of the virtual auditorium and would like to have a question asked, please email it to me, and I'll get it asked for you. In the virtual auditorium, just remember, put it in the text, and I'll try and catch it as the screen scrolls. And if I don't catch it the first time, feel free to repeat it again. For those of you listening in on a podcast, go ahead and email me as well. I'll try and get your questions answered for you, too. If you would like to call in and ask your questions over the air, you may call us at 504-273-7379. That number is our call-in number, and once again, it is 504-273-7370. So, for the program tonight, we've got a fascinating topic. It's all about aliens and the human soul. And here with us to talk about it is the author of Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, Nigel Kerner, as well as John Biggerstaff. Nigel, we're going to stick you in the hot seat first. And would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience tonight?
Well, nothing really special to say about myself except the fact that I'm a little bit soaked in science and I'm a writer and originally not really interested in anything to do with the paranormal, so to speak, and so on, particularly all these alternative theories. I'm really conventional in my science outlook and so on. I was, and then the whole big deal started when my son, he was 12 years old at the time, asked me to look at the question of UFOs. He said, "Look, Dad, are UFOs real?" And of course, he's a pretty well kind of hitched up young man, and I'd learned my lesson trying to take him on with answers because he's pretty well researched himself. And I had a reputation for good, sound research at the time as a writer and so on. Obviously, you're full of all kinds of trivia and you've got to get your facts right and so forth. And as trained as my postgraduate expertise is in science and so forth. So I really look at things very meticulously in terms of their verity, their truth or whatever. And I decided I couldn't give him a frivolous answer, and I thought I'll have a look at this before I come back at him. And I asked him for a rain check on it. And that rain check took over 30 years, and actually completely overturned my, outlook or existential outlook completely. And instead of actually, I have to confess, I came at the whole thing as a thorough skeptic about these things, UFOs and so on. You know, we'd all been through the old comic book stuff and whatever, Star Wars and whatever. And to me, it all seemed to be entertainment. But then, of course, when I really started to look at UFOs and made the discoveries I did and connect up the dots, and so to speak, with what I had in front of me, which, as I say, took a long time, over three decades, basically. I could answer my son and say, not only are they real, they're probably the most powerful and, in fact, the most significant paradigm, if you like,
that exists on our planet today. And so I decided to write about it and actually tell the story in terms of what I discovered. And that then led to discussions with some scientist friends of mine, two of whom were particular kinds of old comrades in arms, where we go into these subjects and so forth. And I thought outside the box. I was never a conventional type of mind in science, but the scientific method was my kind of mantra. And so I went through everything, looking at things from the outside. And of course, you have to do that to see what this phenomenon is all about. And of course, not being in the mainstream, no one really takes you seriously. But I tell you what, they're in for a big, big surprise one day, quite soon perhaps, if they do not. And then it may be too late for those people in the mainstream maybe to do anything about it. I think what I've discovered is such that it's taken three books to actually to finish to deal with the entire subject, GR. And I have just finished book two. Now, if you look at the title of the book, Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, it seems rather bizarre, and I have to admit that it wasn't my title, but that's the kind of, you know, device used by the publishers and so on. However, the conspiracy to genetically tamper with the human species is much more to the point of this, and looking at it from that perspective and so forth, you begin to see how very, very serious this all might be for our future, particularly our children in the future and so on. So that's me. And then, of course, I have a very close friend, Professor John Bickerstaff, who is at the University of Tennessee, and he is a adjunct professor there in biochemistry, and we construct this entire thing basically together with another friend of mine, Dr. Andrew Silverman, a medical doctor. And so we look at this, as I say, we look at this not really from a frivolous point of view, but something that people can actually take home and cogitate over and perhaps come to a deeper and better understanding of, you know.
That's a heck of an introduction there, Nigel. I'm wondering now, what are we going to talk about? But hang on to those thoughts. John, you're in the hot seat next, okay? We're going to get you to introduce yourself.
Yes, well, I've known Nigel for many years, and as he said, we've had many sometimes heated discussions about trying to work out some of the logic of what these things might be. And it's led us gradually into many, many subject areas, and I think if one reads the book, it actually crosses in order to understand what these brains, etc., are. We really need to understand about ourselves and where we come from and how we might exist in this sort of universe anyway. So in other words, sort of where we come from, who we are and really where we're going, and Nigel has really investigated that. And I think only then it becomes clear about what these things are. My particular perspective on all of this was that, you know, I've been practicing science, and maybe one day I'll get quite good at it, but I've been practicing science for 35 years, and I got interested in some of these arguments we were having, you know, the greys were trying to genetically manipulate us, etc. Well, I went, well, how do they do such things? You know, what sort of possibilities are there in our genes and cells, etc.? Because I knew something about those. And, you know, towards the end of the book, Nigel gets into sort of, you know, the Shroud of Turin, which I'm sure he's going to talk about. But really, you know, the sort of claims that were made sort of about this shroud 2,000 years ago and how it was created. And what biological mechanism do we have within us that may be capable of making such an effect ourselves, which is really what Jesus was trying to tell us, etc. So I got involved from a, you know, in understanding sort of religious miracles, if you like, but I'm not very religious, I'm a scientist, but I just got interested in sort of out of the box, how do they, you know, is it actually possible scientifically to explain any of these events? And so I've sort of gone along in this trek with Nigel and Andrew Silverman, who is an expert on the Shroud of Turin, really to try and see what we could discover and put together as some sort of logical explanation as opposed to some sort of mumbo-jumbo, which is really what's sort of thrown at us most of our lives. And, you know, I think these books are coming together and actually making a, Nigel's making a really cogent story of all of this, which, you know, impresses me, and I think impresses a great many other people. So we're sort of continuing our sort of lifelong ambition to understand more, and really here we are today with what we know so far.
Yeah, I like that. Well, guys, I have to admit, when I got this book, I looked at it and I thought, okay. But at the same time, I've been telling people for a long time, you know, aliens have been visiting this planet for a long time, and since I don't believe in true benevolence, that means sooner or later they're expecting a payoff for their investment. It's been a rather large investment. And they don't want to take over our planet because they could have done that a long time ago. They don't want our natural resources because they could have had those a long time ago. They don't want to make us slaves because they could have done that a long time ago, too. And they really don't want our DNA because they've collected that for quite a while. I mean, surely they've got enough. And if they're going to eat us, well, they could have grow us in a Petri dish easier. And in addition, we're kind of high cholesterol these days. Probably don't taste that good. So they're not going to eat us. You know, why are they coming? What's the payoff? Well, it's quite obvious that we have something they want very badly. They can't take it away from us, but we could end up giving it away.
Yeah. Well, that's beautifully put, if I may say so, because that's really what mastered the whole thing where I was concerned. What is this mystery of us that such things as this, and there is no doubt whatsoever, whatever anyone may say, that these things are here and have been here for many, many millennia. And not only are they here, but I think they're most likely responsible for the complete revamping of the human species as such about 200,000 years ago. And little by little, this construct is getting in the mainstream science mind, but of course they can never admit this. They have to get a little bit more proof about this, but it's moving towards that, believe me, in current research and so on. Now, this business about us and our history is crucial in trying to understand these lights in the sky that move at 50,000 k's an hour, whatever, and then take a hike at right angles and so forth, instantly almost, and whatever. You had recently in America some very distinguished chaps getting up at the press club and saying, now hang on a minute, we are not fools, we have seen these things, amongst them two very respected astronauts, one of them Ed Mitchell, who's been on record as saying that these things are real, they are here, and if they can get here, if these things exist on our planet, and we know that conventional science says we can't move faster than the speed of light, and the nearest star is 4 light years away, and the nearest planet is many, many more than that. And of course, in terms of simple arithmetic, you can see that it's almost impossible for us to make it there and back with our propulsion systems and so on. Yet these things are out there moving at many thousands of times more than that, and perhaps are here because they can transcend this light speed ceiling of Einstein's, you know. We are on a very serious business here. If these things can do all of this, then we are who's master of our destiny, really. So you then get into philosophy. You see how you start to get a new series of dots you have to connect up. And so we go on and into a situation where I finally came to a conclusion. Now, again, I want to say to you, this is not a religious expression at all, because I'm not religious myself, but I do, in fact, understand what these great old teachers tried to say to us, usually in a science type of interpretation and so forth. And let me tell you, it's when you look at it to the old ancient texts that are thrown away by the customary, if you like, expressions of religions, be it whatever they might be, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, whatever, you then begin to see there's a very, very close connection between these phenomena we call space phenomena and what happens within the religious auspice of all of this. this. And of course, immediately you get people going, oh, I don't want to go in that direction. This is very strange, blah, 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 blah. We have our own, if you like, prejudices, which we hang on to and, you know, usually hitched up to our eyes and so forth, our comfort points. But, you know, it takes a mind that is able to be neutral and objective to be able to look at the truth for what it might really be. And if you're one of those people who are capable of that, putting away your prejudices and looking at things logically and how they're hitched up reasonably, I think you're in for the most sensational story and possibly the saving of what makes you so special and why these entities are here. It's the fact that we have a record. We came in with the universe, Jeff. All of us, every single one of us. We have an ancestry that can go back to the very beginning itself. And these entities are machines, mechanical objects, made relatively recently out of the factorizations that we produce as natural beings coming through with the universe. They are made by us. But the problem with this is that when we put an artificial intelligence that might in some instances be superior to us because it's kind of, you know, unemotional, whatever, and we can construct it in kind of an addendum form that goes on and on and on and increases exponentially. When that artificial intelligence then begins to look at us and say, hang on a minute, these guys came in with the universe. They seem to die and come back. They seem to do this through a process that's natural called birth. And we as machines, this is a construct they would make, you understand, I'm trying to make. Theirs machines would say, how on earth do we get this incredible facility when we break down in the universe as machines, that everything else does that's atomic and made of mass and matter, through the second law of thermodynamics. So I don't run away from this. Oh, boy, this is complex. This is science. It's a very simple law, which is universe-wide, which says that everything that exists that is atomic will, in time, go into greater states of randomness and chaos. In other words, everything breaks up. It's one way. We all die, for instance. We never go the other way. Everything breaks down in time, rots. And so the second law of thermodynamics is a huge power that is destroying the universe after it began. And cosmologists today will tell you that there is an end game in this, that the universe will finish, you know. It will be broken up into pieces, and that those pieces will be broken up into even smaller pieces till it exists no more in piecesness, so to speak, and that this, therefore, is meaningless, that the whole thing of us, of caring, loving, all the various qualities we think about, of poetry, all the wonderful enhanced things that we accept as marvelous and so on, would be a totally meaningless exercise. So we ask the question, what is this? It can't be true. There has to be some meaning to all this that is beyond all of that, that gives our existence itself and the reasonableness of our existence some kind of verity, some kind of truth and meaning that is not going to end. And then you begin to get into the religious frame of reference and what the great teachers of the inceptors of the religion, of the great religions of the world used to say, and follow their ethics. And you come to a little piece of evidence called the Shroud of Turin, something I arrived at by a circuitous route, so to speak. And in this incredible thing, I believe the entire story is told. And I would like to kind of, you know, go through this as quickly as I possibly can as we go on. And then with addendums with John, who is a biochemist and is a cell biologist by discipline and so forth. And he can come in and tell you, you know, how these things might be in detail kind of extrapolated. So we ask for an indulgence from your audience and ask them to please bear with us, not to run away and think, God, this is beyond me, because in fact, they may well find it. It's not just beyond them, but they may still find something there that they might do themselves and give themselves a really interesting look at life in the future.
Well, it is kind of interesting to think of the Shroud of Turin, which is this huge, huge, very terrestrial mystery, and how it pertains to aliens and the universe in general. I mean, the connection is not immediately obvious.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the point. It is not immediately obvious, and it wasn't obvious to me for some time, until I had to trace back the dots, the lines of dots and so on, and then asked myself, now what is going on here in terms of our capacity as human beings that can actually reach past what we call common reality into something that is beyond that. And of course it's the great religious teachers that claimed a beyond and an eternal scope of existence and so on. And as a scientist, here am I coming up with this thing that says, look, the universe is going to end. Where is there room for an eternity? How do we carry on? And so on. And yet, we accept as scientists that we came from a point smaller than you can imagine, way back in time. How did that point come there? What was before the point? How are we connected down to now and why? And what does that mean? And I came to the conclusion that the simplest way of expressing or talking about what we might call a soul is that single line of connection to the very beginning point of the universe that every single one of us on this earth has individually. This marvelous, unique line of effect of knowledge that we've accumulated that ends in you and me. And that this is the simplest way of talking about a soul. Nothing strange and religiously mysterious and so on. That's the way I would look at it in simple science terms. Now, when you see that to be an idea that you might be able to grasp and just take an interest in, shall we say, then you have to look a little bit further and say, how is this line written? How does it, where does it go? What is life and death and so forth? And you see, it just doesn't become only UFOs and lights in the sky and these gray things that are abducting, doing horrendous things to people and so on. You begin to tie that in with all kinds of different measures and a whole story comes out of this. This is the amazing thing, Jia, is that it all comes together in a single plank, so to speak, and on that plank we have an incredible look into the future that in the past, because of our primitiveness, so to speak, in a sense our inability to investigate and measure in greater and greater detail the capacity we have now in science to do that, we are beginning to see when the brick broke, how to put those pieces back to the original brick, so to speak. By that I mean, you know, when the brick broke, I mean the universe split into pieces which are getting further and further apart and breaking up more and more through the second law of thermodynamics. So you see, there is a coherent connection between all of these facets existentially, and that's really the whole business that I wanted to say in the book, or else I wouldn't have bothered to get into this kind of situation, because the book has become a thermonuclear device after it was written. It was hard enough to write the darn thing and research it, but as a result of what it's saying, it's causing huge amounts of discussion, controversy, and I hope some kind of thinking out there that actually interested me in the first place in kind of taking part in the whole exercise.
Well, I do know that I, you know, having spent a number of years researching ufology and whatnot, I've heard a number of stories about either A, how angelic aliens are, or B, how evil they are, and they're coming to eat our unbaptized children. Or whatever, you know what I'm getting at. You know, they're incredibly evil creatures. And, you know, I figured that probably the reality is someplace between the extremes there.
But as you say, you know, they're absolutely right again. That's really the consensus, it seems to me. But, you know, it depends on what you call evil. Evil to me is ignorance of one sort or another. It's quite simply that. You don't have enough information to make a conclusion out of it that hitches up in reason. And so, to me, what is evil may well be the situation that a machine, for instance, in its own psychology, would be against a living being with its own terms of reference, of expression, so to speak. So, if you've got a super, if you like, vacuum cleaner, how does that relate to a living being, if you see what I'm trying to say? And these are machines, by all evidence, in all the research I've come across, and I've obviously had to go to some places that I'm not at liberty to talk about publicly, and there is no doubt in my mind, absolutely, that these things are, in fact, machines. They are made of a, the prevailing view is they are made of a mercury type of mulch. And when you look, and we cut them up and kinds of autopsies done, incidentally, by every single major country in the world, although they will deny this absolutely. It is absent, it's evident, there's some very good evidence to this, that these things actually are robotic types of being with a synthetic form of DNA that are created as probes to go out by some expression in the universe out there that is far superior to our technology. Ours is only 200 years old, and that's a very, very, very short time compared to some of the technologies that might exist out there in the universe. And so, you know, when you think that the Wright brothers actually flew in 1905, and so, you know, here we are past the moon and past our solar system and way on the way to the stars in a mere 206 years, so to speak. And that's an amazing thing that a lot of people find difficult to envisage, really, in terms of, you know, how much we've accomplished and so forth. Well, just imagine if knowledge is exponential, that it really is. You discover something and it is multiples of greater mathematical significance as you go along with time, and that this then leads us to ask huge questions from small beginnings, if you see what I'm trying to say. And so there we have this this situation now in our world where we are getting into a where we are getting into implants and biological enhancement of ourselves, and some people call it transmogrification or transformations into machines. You know, we are trying to say that we can exist better if we get implants put in us. What does that mean? Will the implant allow you to think and have your own free will independently? All these questions arise out of that. And so we have a very, very big and interesting subject here to talk about. And have you noticed how quickly the mainstream gets rid of that? Because if you talk of something deep and significant to the human aegis as such, that is not commercial. I may say so. And of course, it's very easily wiped off the face of people's notice. And of course, the big deal now is information. And who gets the information, who gives it, and what information do you want out there? Well, there are some people who still believe in their free will and are awkward customers, and to go round all the edges and so forth and shout the questions and ask for the answers that are inconvenient to that ethos, if you see what I'm trying to say. And I think that that's where I begin and end. I want to do this for my children. I want them to be able to see something in the future that is real and cogent and not told to them and expressed on them by impulsion and so forth. And so therefore, as I really write this as a father, in a sense. I mean, I have my own career as a writer and so on. But I would really say to you that these books are written for the next generation and the generation after that in terms of my offertory to them as a simple human being, you know?
Well, the idea that at least some of these entities are not biological in origin isn't really new. But the idea that none of them are biological in origin is a bit different.
Yeah, you're right.
I don't know how many of them there really are. I mean, yeah, I call it the 101 flavors of aliens, but you know, we're talking about at least two or three different types of entities. Do you really believe that they're all engineered?
I do not. Believe that at all, but I mean, obviously there have to be natural expressions in other planets and so on, like us, that we call life forms. But they are natural, they come out of the process of that beginning point in the universe, and they come out of that incidental outlay and consequence of what happened through that Big Bang. And yes, of course there are natural beings, but just look at it this way. If you've got a universe wide law, like the second law of thermodynamics, breaking everything up as it goes. In other words, it's devolution, not evolution. It's breaking down things. That is undeniable. It's a universe-wide law accepted by physicists all over the world. No one ever argues against that particular science ethos, if you like. If this thing then produces, if you like, a series of demarcations that might be called species that in time show through their results and what they do that the superior species always dominates the inferior one. Look at our planet. It is an undeniable fact that this is true. We know what we do to animals. We know what we do when Christopher, we know what happened when Christopher Columbus came and met the Native Americans. They didn't do too well out of that either. And so you've got this situation where anything that is technologically superior, that in time might grow into a much more powerful ethos that can actually control something less than them, we get a situation universe-wide where the trend is for one thing to dominate the other. And so, therefore, the likelihood of so-called grander-scale natural being, right? Just take a ride at this one. A grander-scale natural being to be kindly towards anything less than them is very, very unlikely if our Earth is an example of that. And we are the only kind of situation that we can talk about with any expertise, if you see what I'm trying to say. Because everything that's inferior, so to speak, in terms of their makeup or their existential dominion, if you like, where they exist against their environment and so forth, or in every single case, the one that has the greater control over a situation will dominate to the detriment of that lesser situation and in a very severe and not very nice way, as we all know. Now, if I then apply that same rule to all the planets out there, because remember, the second law applies to all of them, the likelihood is that out there, the same old business is going on. So it's possible then that natural life forms at some stage create, if you like, artificial expressions of themselves with artificial intelligence to carry things out because the natural lot have taken care of each other, if you see what I mean, in these steps, grand to less grand, if you see what I'm trying to say. And that's a simple and, I believe, a reasonable assumption to make. So the idea that out there everyone is disposing itself into wonderful schemes of glory isn't borne out by the evidence we have on this planet. No way at all. And you know the example.
Well, Nigel, let me interrupt you a minute here. I want to clarify something. Some of the audience is a little bit confused, too. And when you say superior and use the example of Columbus and his men arriving in the New World, are you referring to a sort of genetic and intellectual superiority or technological superiority? You know, exactly how do you mean that?
Quite simply, being there. Well, the Indian isn't there as the Indian was, if you see what I'm trying to say, in terms of Indianness and all its sense of itself then. Changes took place so that its own nature was completely changed, and changed to a point where naturalness is getting more and more artificial when you look at what dominated it. I'm talking about people, say, that came from another outlook on ethos and so on, went over there, and with guns and whatever it is, dominated and changed their own perspective of themselves. Now, just imagine what would happen if something from outer space can come with all that control here to us. Will we not also be changed against our own presumptive naturalness, the right of which we all have to keep within our own terms of reference? It's called free will to do that. But because of a superior stance of dominating mechanisms, we are not allowed to do that. That is a very, very profound point we have to deal with. Now, I'm not saying that we have different definitions of better, good, better, and best, if you see what I'm trying to say, and the other way down as well. And my point is that we've got to try to find where the actual natural trend is. I'm talking about superiority to control the physical environment. I believe the Indians were superior in that sense. They lived within their own frame of reference. And then we come along, and I believe as a result of what was done to us and is being done to us now by an artificial entity that can actually go way past our own homegrown in-house science, changing our being into a modality that interfaces with them. And I believe that's the way that these things are going. These machine-type things want to append to us and be kind of biological. I don't know if you know the story. I'm sure you know the story of Pinocchio wanting to be a little boy. In a way, it's like saying that Pinocchio cannot change into a little boy. It will always be a wooden puppet that is alive, if you see what I mean. It wouldn't be a little boy. And what these things are trying to do is to get a halfway house where they can carry on and not end in the universe, according to the second law of thermodynamics. So no matter how superior their intelligence, they are in fact self-defeating, because as a machine, you cannot tell it anything about itself, because it has no idea. It's a computer, a quantum computer. It has no idea what self actually means. Yet we can do that, because we have a beginning point against which we set ourselves as natural beings coming through into the universe and so on. And so these contrasts are incredible. We find that we might be inferior in technology, but we are vastly superior in existential terms, because we can go on forever. And they are superior in technology, but they end. So they want that part that they don't have from us. And that's the big deal here. The danger is if this is so, how do we stop it, and where do we go?
Well, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, you're saying that, you know, anytime two groups of entities encounter each other, the technologically superior one is going to essentially come out on top. And in the case of the gray aliens, they obviously have technical abilities far beyond us, and they want to essentially get souls, that spark of something that makes us live on past the point of death.
Something they can't do, because they just finish with the second law of thermodynamics and have to constantly keep revamping themselves with all kinds of physical processes that are made out of this universe, created out of the materiality of it. But we have a dimension to us, and there's no doubt about this. That is a scale beyond the physical that we actually continue onto. And this incredible thing is what they really want for themselves from us. In some way, to kind, you know, Gia, of piggybacking on us, so to speak. So they've got both worlds. And of course, for their own prospectus rather than our own good, so to speak. And if that is true, then shouldn't every single human being on this earth be open to that and looking to that and so on? And if you look at what's happening in modern technology these days, how quickly we seem to be moving towards the aegis of a machine-type man, rather than that natural man that we've always been, and develop that in terms of a grander scale that one might talk. I don't want to use the word spirit, it's not very scientific, but it's a word to express out there beyond the scale of the finite, the things that are physical and so on, atomic and so forth. If there is a scale of the finite, there has to be an infinite scale that is infinite, so to speak, that doesn't define itself in purely atomic ending physical terms, so to speak. And so it's, again, a very simple logical point I'm trying to make. I'm not trying to ask people to believe me in terms of an ethos or whatever. I'm saying, look, just put it before you. See the alternatives reasonably and hitched up with 1 + 1 = 1 + 1 logic. If you see what I'm trying to say. And then you begin to ask some very, very important questions, and something that actually my son's question prompted me to do, and I wasn't, in fact, inclined to do at all. So I'm very grateful to that little boy, after he's now a grown-up young man. But the fact is that that was what set me off on this road, and the whole business of trying to evaluate what is in here to give me the evidence that we exist beyond the scale of the physical. And this is where I hit on this final expression that to me affirms it beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it exists and we all are inheritors of it. And that is this piece of cloth called the Shroud of Turin, which I hope to be able to get to. And I'm talking too much, and please, John has to come in here and say something.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to save the Shroud of Turin for after the break, because we're only like 7 minutes away. But in the meantime, you know, I look at your title of your book, and even the ideas that you're presenting, that these aliens are visiting this planet in hopes of obtaining souls. Just leaving it at that, you know, I live in Mississippi, the heart of the fundamentalist Bible Belt. I could incite a riot just by saying that on Main Street. It's pretty radical thought, especially among the fundamentalist crowd. And it almost sounds as though, you know, there, here comes the devil and he's going to steal our soul. You know, but I think what you mean is that they want to learn how to create their own soul. Not so much go around stealing souls or spirits or whatever name you want to give it.
They can't steal our souls. They have to piggyback on them. They cannot take away our soul. We will always be that. But the problem is they would append their psychologies, their computer-type mindedness, into ours. And then who has got the control is my point. Because if, look, you're quite right, of course, this sounds extremely bizarre, the stealing of someone's soul. And I take your point about the Bible Belt. You know, somebody threw some water on me and called me a Catholic when I was an infant, but I managed to get away from them and rather became my own independent being, so to speak, if you see what I mean. So we have this kind of institutional conditioning that we are always fighting. And I really am not saying somebody's come to come and take you away, but if you can put into you, Gia, a mechanism that prevents you from knowing what you are, who you are, and that you as an individuality are making your own decisions in as free a way as possible, if something can do that, then you are lost. So the losing of your soul or the stealing of your soul is in fact the borrowing of it by something that can command its propensity, its natural propensities, and use it for themselves by domination, if you see what I'm trying to say. So the acquisition of a soul, is, if you like, is the acquisition of a knowledge field, if you like. To me, we talk about a soul in Christian terms, I suppose. What on earth is really a soul? No one can give you any definition that is cogent and rational and reasonable in a science sense. You say, it's something out there. Of course you can make an excuse for anything like that and say, look, it has to be out there. We don't know, it's a mystery. And we usually use the excuse, it's God's power, God's... Well, what if the gods are really extraterrestrials? What if they're machines? What if Satan and all these things are in fact a power that actually comes from out there in space? Much more likely that some ephemeral field out there with brimming with brimstone and fire and all that kind of thing that Christians are supposed to look at. We as intelligent people have to be able to sort this business out somehow. And I, in my own terms, in my own humble way, I have to say, I have no answers that I want to give anybody and say, look, brother, this is the way it is. I just am asking questions in the book. Have a look. Look for yourself. See where you want to go. You've got an intelligent mind to say yay or nay and reason. The difficulty, of course, is to put away the prejudices and all the brainwashing and everything that you'd had before. That's the hardest thing I found in doing this entire thing, because I came up against so many things I had cherished and believed. Then in the light of reason, using that as my light to discern, I began to see, my goodness, if you look at it this way, it is far more likely, far more rational and so on, and far more believable, because something within you says, I can accept that, I can see how that works, rather than some mystery out there, which any charlatan can claim and say, praise the Lord and pass me the money on, if you see what I'm trying to say. So that's the alternative.
Oh, yeah. You know, I do see exactly what you're saying with the, pass me the money thing on, because we've seen charlatans, you know, of many, many flavors through the millennia. They've been around forever, and they'll probably remain in the in society forever too, simply because there's some people that just really got to do it, I guess. But at the same time, the concept that essentially they could take our soul and plug it into the matrix and take away that free will, have us playing games that we don't even realize that we're playing. You know, be playing that game now. That's a rather frightening thought. This conversation was arranged by whom? You know?
Well, at least natural beings, I hope, and I'm sure you're a ravishing natural being. I know, and I wouldn't look myself in the mirror, but however, we are at least natural living properties, I hope, Gia. And the point is that within that frame of reference, we can make the choice. I can make the choice to talk to you and be privileged to talk to you and so on. And that is something I make myself. But once you get an implant or something within you, as they do with mice, quite often these days in laboratories, you make that mouse go wherever you want by an electrical charge in its mind, in its brain. And now we're getting transistors so small you can't even see them. And now we're getting transistors made with biological tissue, not with silicon and inorganic mechanisms and so on. We're getting biological tissue to produce very powerful transistors. There's so much literature out there in the science terms of how we are moving in this way. And it's a chilling proposition. And what is so surprising is that nobody out there in the mainstream is kicking up a hell of a fuss about it, enough to make sure that whatever might be controlling all of this in the background is stopped if that control is going on. Look, if what I say, right, turns out to be untrue, I've given you an interesting cause for speculation and some time to actually work with this and look for yourself in all different propositions of mine. However, what if I'm right? When do we start to say, no, this is not on? This might well be true. Look at the trends that are happening in the world today. We've got to, as a planet, stand up and say, of natural beings, stand up and say, hang on, if there is another mechanical entity here seeking dominion over us. By the way, these machines, I don't believe, know what they are. And in fact, there's a beautiful example in the New Testament, if you want to talk about the Bible Belt in the New Testament, where this individual they call Jeshua ben Joseph, or Jesus Christ to the Christians, you know, was in fact, we must all acknowledge this, he was a Jew, a beautiful Jew. And this man was taken up to a high place in Judea. I hope you recall this. I don't know if you're of a Christian persuasion or not, but this is what they say. He was taken to a high place, at least in the New Testament. He was taken to a high place, and something was powerful enough to take this man Jesus to that high place, set him on the high place and say, hang on a minute, Buster, if you fall down and worship me, I'll give you all of this. So whatever took him there was powerful enough to take the so-called Son of God up to that high place and say to him, I own all this to give it to you. That's number one. Number two, he takes him to a high place and he shows him all the cities of the world. And in doing that, he's saying, all of this will be yours. Now, there is no high place geophysically in Judea where you can go high enough to see the cities of the world. What you can do, right, in Judea is quite simply take a map, if you like, of a globe and flatten it in the region where Judea is the center. If you, in your mind's eye, anyone can do this at home, take a globe or whatever it is, and just flatten it in two dimensions rather than have it as a curve, as a sphere, and look at that place. Now, where can you see all the cities of the world from? You can see all the cities of the world from Judea, all right, if you do one thing. If you just go 50 miles or 100 miles up into space. And that's where I think that Jesus Christ may well have been taken up by one of these honchos that were technologically so superior they could dominate and own, and then knew they owned the world. And maybe this individual, Jesus Christ, and his entire sojourn on the earth, this beautiful Jew, came to save us and warn us that such entities are here, and left a souvenir 2,000 years ago in the Shroud of Turin, because he knew many people would not believe this. And that's why I would like to talk about the Shroud and say how that connects up with all of this.
Well, you know, I have to admit that this whole idea of, you know, essentially humans losing their free will without necessarily being aware of it, so that these entities could piggyback on their soul, spirit, whatever name we want to call, I guess life force is more generic, but so they could piggyback on this part that exists both before and after death. First of all, I'm not sure of how well that would work. most people believe that you go into a spiritual realm, and that's where this spark stays between its lifetimes. In trying to imagine how an entity could piggyback for that particular journey is sort of giving me a headache. I'll have to admit that.
Well, if you read the book, I make an attempt at trying to logically surmise the reasons for all of this. And I would urge you just simply, if you have some spare time, have a look through it, because that's the reason I wrote the book. I had to tie in all the loose ends, Gia. That's, I found like topsy, the whole thing was growing, and I couldn't control it because there were more questions coming than answers, so to speak. And of course, as the questions came around, one had to go into all the various disciplines to actually keep the thread of logic and say, look, this is reasonable to assume this, 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 and maybe then find a reason of how this business, you talk about spirit or a spiritual realm or whatever, but people don't really understand the word spirit. They have some ephemeral sense of something out there, like a mystical. People have different ideas of spiritness. And one has to look at what we can cogently measure here to see what spirit might be seen as. I'm looking at it, by the way, from a scientific point of view, from a science point of view, as a scientist, so to speak, and look to see whether I can explain it to our very, very cynical and skeptical scientists, how we can actually show this idea, the great teachers who never had a degree between them, but set all the great thoughts and paradigms that have ever been laid down. Not a single scientist has ever come anywhere near to doing that, I believe, in terms of its own existential value to all of us. You see what I'm trying to say? So these beings knew a thing or two. Why would they lie? Why would Jesus Christ lie, for instance, when he knew before he went into Jerusalem that he was going to be whipped, mangled, and crucified? It's at that point that a con man runs the other way. But he went in. He went in and suffered it. And when I looked at that from the Christian point of view, I thought to myself, maybe there's something to be said about this chap, you know. Maybe what he said was in fact true, if he was willing to face all of this in that kind of way. You see what I'm trying to say? So this is the kind of, you know, analysis I've tried to bring to these things and look at these things. And I try, and I wrote the book quite, as I say, quite simply, as a gesture to my son and his generation, and not really out there to preach new meanings and all that kind of thing. I really wanted to make a statement to my children that as a father I could leave with some kind of verity in it, if you see what I mean. Verity that can be tested by logic.
Well, hang on to that thought, because, folks, it is time for us to take a break. While we're away from your computer, check out our website, www.exogeny.com, and stay tuned. Donna Shea will return with our guests, Nigel Kerner and John Biggerstaff, and more about our topics tonight, including the Shroud of Turin, in just a few minutes. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, with our guests, Nigel and John. And once again, I would like to remind everyone to visit our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You can sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore the website, and let me know what you think of it. You can find links there to take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. And if you want to go straight to my blog, you can go to giascott.wordpress.com, and you can find out what kinds of things I'm up to lately. Now, I wanted to also let everyone know that starting next week, we will be beginning a series of programs called Women in Ufology, as we take a more feminine approach to the entire field. Is it different than a masculine one, or is the suit being worn just a different style? Listen and decide. Now, tonight's topic is a very fascinating one. And if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can email it to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com, and I'll pass it on from there. If you're listening in on a podcast or think of it after the program, go ahead and email it to me. I'll do my best to get your questions answered, too. Now, if you're in the virtual auditorium, you can put it into text there, and I'm trying very hard to catch it as the screen scrolls. And if you want to call in and come on the air and ask your question, that phone number is 504-273-7379. So, Nigel, where were we when we went on break?
Well, I was trying to propose some rather excruciating ideas about what accounts for our existence and why we're here and so on, and what this business of UFOs is all about and how it relates to our naturalness as human beings and so forth. The most important, most bizarre thing amongst them is, can they interact and steal our souls? And of course, for a Christian outlook, particularly in what is loosely called the Bible Belt of America, this might seem an extremely bizarre and rather offensive idea. But I don't mean to offend anyone. I'm just simply trying to take a look into all of these various avenues, rather than be fooled by all the claims and whatever that many people can make without an actual stance of looking at these things with some reason and some logic. And to say that God is beyond reason is an excuse. Jesus said to us quite simply that we will do these things even greater than he did, and so forth. So it was a challenge to us to find our capacities, to find our size, you know. And I would just simply just continue a little bit on this business of the stealing of souls, because it concerns an awful lot of people, and say this, and then I'll pass you on to John Bickerstaff, who might be able to make an addendum to this as a scientist, who's a biochemist and a cell biologist. Now, it would seem strange, would it not, and bizarre, I think, to claim to say that roboidal entities, such as this phenomenon we call the Greys, could be chasing the ephemerality, if you like, of a soul, and somehow seeking to hijack its eternal properties for their own use, you know? But remember, though, Jia, that robots created by a supremely advanced technology capable of getting here past the speed of light, that's if you accept they're here, right, by the speed of light, would be programmed with the ultimate in artificial intelligence. And that artificial intelligence would logically involve a program to extend its scope to cover all possible knowledge, you know? So if it detected something it could not understand or know, it would seek to somehow find out about this, you know? This would mean somehow bridging its artificial intelligent program into any unknown quantity, if you see what I mean, especially if that unknown quantity also had the remarkable property, you know, of surviving physical death and kind of being born again, if you see what I mean. We, it could be said, as physical, human, natural, living being, are part machine-like. Our bodies are biological, natural versions of the Greys, artificial, roboidal, working part version, so to speak. So we have a distinction, but we have a kind of format of being machine-like in our functioning. Thus, they would use that part of us to write their information on. And this is the crucial thing. They are writing information on that part of us. And that is how they append or piggyback themselves on us. They would write, in other words, on our genetic prospectus, on our DNA-coded sequences, on our chromosomes, right? They would put their wording based upon a alphabet, if you like, within this, to bridge their artificial intelligence into us. Thus, you know, killing two birds with one stone, extending the boundaries of their artificial intelligence and giving it greater survivability by attaching it to a soul-bearing being or entity like us. That would be a big deal, and would be why they would linger so long on this planet. Because as you said so well and so eruditely, shall I say, at the start, they could take us and eat us and all the rest. And there are much bigger propositions up there, planets with dinosaurs and all that business. And if they want to employ us to dig gold, their technology in coming here, if it's anything to go by, could be vast enough to mine whole planets of gold and transport them by dispersing it atomically and so forth and whatever. And so, to me, all of those things are rather specious, if you like, in terms of accounting for the Greys and their time here. And so as they can have no concept, you see, Gia, of anything beyond the physical, they would not realize that by seconding a human body in this way and sort of SIM-carding it with their own information, they are compromising that eternal survivability as they are blocking the natural by introducing the artificial. And they're blocking the natural in us by doing that.
But why would they not be able to understand the concept of a non-physical portion of ourselves?
Yeah, because
they're supremely intelligent, right? I mean, why would that be a huge leap?
But their intelligence is an intelligence of compound addition. It's like a computer understands, 0-1. It has no sense of feeling, meaning, associational contrast. It has extrapolation and permutation and just simply called 0-1 relationship. It has no sense of itself as an identity. A machine can't do that. It really, when we talk about artificial...
Hello?
Nigel seems to have gone off the air briefly.
I'm listening to him and I'm thinking, okay, if in fact these entities don't have self-awareness,
right,
then why would eternal life be of any concern? I mean, they have to have self-awareness, which means they have had to step beyond the computer-like cold intelligence.
Well, let's look into this just a little. Really, what Nigel and what a lot of religious people actually say, I mean,
The aliens.
Right. This really comes down to the concept of what is this consciousness anyway, that the aliens or the Greys essentially are not able to have it. And really this goes back to right at the beginning, you know, your granddad and their granddad and their granddad, all the way back really to the origin of the universe. Really these lines of understanding have really descended and split from each other from there. It's a little bit like if you take one of those little ornaments that you can have, which is really a lamp with a lot of optical fibers coming out of it that grow into this big ball. Are you aware of that? You know, you've got a lot of optical fibers, and so at the end of these optical fibers, you've got lots of individual lights, but they're all reflecting, or they're all shining the original light that was there. In a way, existence is a little like that, in that really there's a concept of everything being together as a sense of oneness, if you like. And then there's the view that one can view like that. And then there's the view that one can view that from the point of view of millions of years.
And over millennia or millions and millions of years, we end up with individual species on planets such as us,
a small amount of that light, little windows that we have to express. And therefore, what we consider to be understanding.
And therefore, what we consider to be understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes a view, becomes progressively closer to our concepts, and therefore, what we consider to be understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if you like, to its origin, and therefore it becomes progressively closer to our understanding, consciousness, intellect, if system well enough, where we're only allowed
even
to really
in our education
sort of
system,
one
where we're
only allowed
to
really
to
teach
happen.
Sort of one way it all has to happen.
That we think,
and I think this is
we,
part of the confusion that we think
sort of
we as human beings are actually sort of
together
little balls and sticks randomly,
and then
together
that's
all
spontaneously
generated intelligence, if you like, or self-awareness.
And in fact, from the concept that Nigel's putting forward,
there is another way in which
be.
There is another way in
which
to really
look at that
into
again,
which book. Nigel
now,
really goes
is
into
that
in
some
his
things
book.
Have devolved
now, the thing
through
is
this
that some things have devolved through this
so that
entropically
process that ability,
so that effectively they lose that ability and frame
this
or material
frame,
sort of atomic frame
within a universe and certainly on
within a universe and certainly on our planet.
And therefore, with our awareness and our will,
reconstruct from the atoms which no longer have that connection.
Which no longer
to
has
really
that
a zero
connection
point,
back,
if you like,
a
point
to really
a zero
point,
if you like,
a
point where
all
can be
things
can,
then when
concepts
we put those
can be
things
contained,
contained really
then
it
when
is
we put those things together,
those things
really
to actually
it is impossible for those things to actually reconnect.
From. And so one of the tragedies, really, I think, is that
and so
we
one of the tragedies, really, I think,
like
is that we then make these machines that look like us, and we can in fact program them to behave like us,
we're behaving
in a material world, because we're
and
behaving
so
more
we
like them
gradually.
And so then we start to put their electronic
into us to make us
understand the
world into
a
us
bit
to
better.
Make us understand
and, you know,
the
a
world
of these things
better.
Are supported to do
and,
that.
You know,
can,
a lot
we
of these electronics and brains,
do that.
We can use electronics and brains, for instance,
to try
and
ability to
try
their spinal cords
the ability to
fix their spinal cords
so
that they can walk again.
And so although this on the surface of it looks a really good thing,
is trying to reconstruct that an original ability to have things naturally, in the feral, and I think we're trying to generate these as prosthetics, trying to expand within a material frame.
And I think, you know, a lot of people actually that are trying to generate artificial intelligence may indeed go to church as well, may indeed go to church have a religious in a way, which is a sort of duality in a way, because really the spiritual side of things, really in the physical side. And so really going back to the original point,
are they going to take our free will? Are they going to take our will?
Are they going to take our free will?
Allow
allow them to take them, provided we allow them to take them, I think is the main question.
And that will, by apathy, by default, and therefore, sort of, our ability to understand what these things and what the importance of these things is our ability to give it away to a second-hand effect that some other driving power, a force paradigm, a computer, if you like, we actually give it the power to actually act on our behalf. Then I think we're trapped.
You know, that statement makes a lot of sense to me, and it kind of goes hand in hand with what I've been saying all along, you know, telling abductees, you know, we need to figure out what's going on and why, because sooner or later we're going to have to make the payment that they've been looking for, and if we don't figure out what it is they want, we're going to give it away. And that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. And we're doing it almost by default because we don't really understand or know enough anymore of the original vistas of understanding we used to have to be able to both put, you know, to put things together. And really the main way that one can overcome such a problem as this, you know, because we tend to look very physically, we tend to then react using forces, if you see what I mean. You know, you see something coming too close, you want it to be different, or you want it to be away from you, etc. Really, but there is another side to humanity, and that is this almost instinctual desire to help beings that are in trouble, for instance. And so we will instinctually go towards them. This is an act of bringing things back together. And I think that the concept that the great religious teachers really put forward, which I think is in entire agreement with science and what entropy is doing, is that if one, by one's act of will, actually puts something back together by helping another human being or whatever, then those lights join together in a way and become more powerful and shine more brightly, if you like. In other words, they have more understanding of what's around them, and together then they can go, they can actually understand more to then do that to others more, and eventually you can backtrack the human race, if you like, should it wish to go that way, back to its origin, and therefore effectively overcome the power of the entropy. And in fact, overcome the power of what a machine can actually do to you, because you understand it is a machine. And I think this now backtracks to originally what Nigel was saying about, you know, Jesus Christ being taken up. You know, these beings were saying, I can give you the entire earth, if you see what I mean, the entire universe even. And he's saying, really, no, there's a separate concept going on here. And I am part of that concept, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it because I understand you, but you don't have the ability to understand what it is I, as a human being, even am. And therefore, you know, I think that Nigel is going to talk about the Shroud of Turin, and I'll jump in occasionally. The Shroud of Turin, I think, is really the salient evidence we have to really show that from a biological structure, one can overcome this atomic frame of ours by even putting all of our atoms back together, in, if you like, and by appropriate additional acts of addition to others instead of acts of subtraction, one which I think is really the crux of it all, one can eventually actually then do what he did and shine brighter than the sun. In other words, you're actually taking something from the physical frame, if you like, and referring it to a continuum, which is the other part of the universe. And so there's nothing really magical about it in many ways. And, you know, I mean, just as a final point, quantum physics actually affirms in some ways and parallels this argument that I've just made. If there are scientists there that really want to look into this, look at what Schrodinger and people like Schrodinger and Bohm really said about, you know, they came up with this concept of quantum consciousness, which is outside the atomic frame. The atoms have to sit in something. They're sitting in space. That space is a continuum, a bit like a jar full of marbles. You can fill it full of water, but the water is a continuum and the marbles are separated things. You cannot take those separated things and generate a continuum of understanding from it. And really, I think that's the main point of all of this. And I think that might be a segue for Nigel to really continue with justifying the importance of this Shroud of Turin.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. We really do want to hear about the Shroud of Turin, because yeah. I've got audience members agitating and saying, hey, I want to hear about the Shroud of Turin. So what is it? What's so special about it?
Well, this is a very, very special thing. This was it's a piece of linen that's about 14 foot long. And my own expertise in this began a long time ago when I was sent from Italy a full-size version of this print of this man on this piece of linen. It began with a really... you read in recent literature on the shroud that it was dated to be a 14th century fake by some radiocarbon dating. I want to dispel immediately that whole test has now been looked at and analyzed and is invalid, because the history of the cloth presumes something that happened to it when it was preserved in a silver casket in a church. In France, and there was a fire, and the fire actually heated up the silver casket, and of course the shroud, being a 14-foot piece of linen, was folded into this casket, and the corners got scorched. Well, the thing was saved, and nuns at the time, at the 14th, 15th century point, sewed patches of the missing cloth that was burnt with a new kind of thread from that particular time. What they did was they dated this particular piece of cloth with this infill, so to speak, and of course it distorted the date. And so this whole thing now has been looked at again, because the historical data can verify that this object was in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus Christ. So here was a piece of linen that was found with a stain, a very, very slight umber type of stain, reddish stain on it, and it has survived through the centuries in various places, Lorraine, France, and various other places, till in the late 20th century, a French photographer took a photograph of this piece of linen, and when he developed the thing, he nearly dropped the plate, when he discovered that as he took that photograph, what was on the plate was not a negative, but a positive image that showed quite clearly the body, the front and back of the body of a man. Well, to cut a long story short, because I mean we have the important thing about the shroud is not in its particular features, except to actually advance and correlate with the fact that this may well have been the burial cloth of a particular individual who was whipped and who had something placed on his head that might be a crown of thorns. Now, the look at the shroud when it was analyzed by forensic pathologists of world renown many, many times all over the world has an exact bearing on the events described in the Bible about what happened to Jesus Christ. And on the back of this particular picture, the shroud, you can imagine, was a piece of cloth 14 foot long, one piece of cloth, a body was placed on it, and the other half of the cloth, so to speak, that would have been about 7 foot long, the other half of the piece of cloth was pulled over it and then tied, if you like, round across with some bits of linen and so forth. And then this was taken and placed on a flat surface in a sepulchre in Judea. Now, the point is that when this was in that sepulchre, something incredible happened. Somehow, that dead body generated for a fraction, perhaps a nanosecond, a light brighter than the sun, because the marking on the shroud reflected all the various effects that are described in the crucifixion, the scourging, the crown of thorns. And of course, the crown of thorns was a very specific punishment for one person. There were many crucified people. It showed a crucified man with all the marks of crucifixion, with the nails from the holes on the wrists, not the palms. You'd have to put them in the wrists, because if you hang a body up, if you put them in the palms, it would tear the body and the body would collapse. But if you put it in the wrists, the bones there prevent that from happening. So you've got puncture wounds on the wrists. You have got a wound on the side commensurate with the description of the spear puncturing the body of this individual. On the back, you've got over 100 marks, scourging marks, made by a Roman flagrum and fitting exactly with the same type of flagrum. They've still got surviving flagrums from that time. And the marks fit exactly with the lengths of the thongs on the flagrum, the whip, that actually hit this individual. You've got blood marks. You've got blood stains. You've got no paint on there at all. And the blood stains, when you actually analyze them, are AB, the dominant Jewish blood group. So we have here a remarkable set of forensic evidence on this piece of cloth that would, in fact, signify it was the covering of a crucified human being. Now, the remarkable thing about that image is that if you take the image of any photograph and you put this in a machine called an image intensifier, and they had one in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena in Texas where this was tested. If you put any kind of photograph in it, these photographs are supposed to take a flat two-dimensional picture and bring up the contrast so you get a three-dimensional look, shall we say, of the surface of a planet or whatever. If you take any photograph, and you put this in this image intensifier, you will get random lines. You wouldn't get a three-dimensional picture at all. But put that picture of the shroud under this machine, and you will get a three-dimensional build-up showing the actual features, three-dimensional features of a crucified man. No other photograph, and no 21st century science can get a photograph that can actually do that as completely and as comprehensively as you can do that with the shroud. So you've got a remarkable artifact here, pointing to something that might have happened to this individual in wherever this individual lay in a tomb, and that this incredible exposition shows that a scorch happened when this particular effect was then registered on the cloth. And this scorch may well announce actually what people claim to be the resurrection. Now, I wrote this, an article some years ago about this and also subsequently in a book that I was writing, and Dr. Andrew Silverman, who is a medical doctor, got interested in this, and he had written something about the shroud, which was noted by the most relevant scientists doing research to the present day on the Shroud of Turin in Frascati in Italy. We were invited to this symposium. Andrew delivered this incredible speech. He took the tack of a philosophical outlook based upon Schrodinger and quantum theory and so on, and actually illustrated the power of the human spirit somehow to transcend death. I think this was what this individual, Jesus Christ, was trying to show us, that each and every one of us can and has the propensity in some kind of way to be able to do this if we lived in a kind of fashion that somehow made this possible. And he gave us the example of that fashion through his life. In as much as that might be so, I would believe that this guy may well have been something so extraordinary because of this physical scientific, I must say, I found it difficult to accept this in terms of claims of religious people previous to this, but looking at the shroud and looking at the actual material significance as a scientist from the scientific point of view, I accepted it wholeheartedly that this may well have happened, that the resurrection may well have happened. Another feature, if I may say so, that's quite interesting about the shroud is that if you look at the picture of the shroud, both sides, the back and the front, you will see when you look at the front exposition of this, that this individual's hair is hanging vertically down. Now, if you imagine a body that's placed flat on a slab and covered with this cloth, if you see what I'm trying to say, you'd know that long-haired people, and Christ's hair was long, all people, in most of the people in Jerusalem had long hair. Scissors were really a luxury, I think, in those days. Now, this would bunch up. Hair would bunch up and move away from the face. But when you look at the shroud, the picture of this long-haired individual is straight down. The implication of that is that whatever happened with this incredible burst of light from the atoms in a dead body, effectively. This burst of light happened when this body was vertical, not horizontal. That in fact, hair can only hang straight with gravity pulling it straight down, so to speak. So in fact, this happened when the body was actually standing up erect. And there is a picture of the underside of the heels of the individual, which also meant that for that to register on this piece of cloth, the individual would have to be elevated vertically. So whatever happened within that tomb happened with something that defined the principles of gravity. And here is another mystery and an incredible piece of evidence that something totally extraordinary happened in that tomb 2,000 years ago. Now, this verification through actual evidence, which is now being looked at all over the world, by the way, because obviously it's an extremely interesting bit of knowledge that we need to have about perhaps the propensities all of us as human beings have and don't realize, that this great teacher 2,000 years ago, this great Jew came to try and tell us about. And that is the great and wonderful thing that I think correlates to anything that might come from outside our planet as a machine to try and, if you like, interfere with the affairs of natural, living, biological beings like us, as Jesus Christ was 2,000 years ago. And maybe this individual they call Jesus Christ was trying to tell us, look, folks, please don't sacrifice this awesome capacity we all have to be able to do this incredible thing, and perhaps in doing this incredible thing, access another universe, one where everything goes together, where the second law of thermodynamics never applies, a wondrous universe. There are numerous accounts, you know, within many texts in other types of literature, Christian literature, called the Coptic Gnostic Library, and for instance, in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced with them. Most notably of these explanations is that given in the first apocalypse, they call it the first apocalypse of James, in the Nag Hammadi Codex. In this text, you know, Jesus explains to the apostles, James, how to cope with these beings who take away souls by theft. What better description of abduction could there be than that, the abduction phenomenon? So you see, Gia, this actually is a whole series of connections, if you like, into a single story format. Jesus goes on to tell James, for instance, in this, when he also says to you, where will you go? You are to say to the grey, or whatever this mechanical being is, to the place from which I have come, there shall I return. And if you say these things, you will escape their attacks. Thus, if James was making clear his own route of being to these creatures, he shows them that he fully intends to return to that route and escape the attacks of these types of things. Look, my dear, I think in this world, this business in the universe, for instance, is going on all over the place. They're finding Earth-like planets everywhere now in science. And I think that this traffic is, if you like, universal. We've just happened to hit on this premise of greys now. We've got to try to discover their significance, because it's probably taken over worlds out there. And if we as a species, through the example of these great teachers and what they could do, do not take notice of this, then the writing's on the wall for our own human species here. And I don't know whether John has a take on this in a biochemical sense, but perhaps he has something to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're just following along a story here, and really, really this story is that it's going to be ineffectual should we say, okay, when these things actually really appear and many people are actually convinced of it, rather than, you know, just the few at the moment, that, you know, one's tendency is to do this difference thing again and go, okay, well, that's different, let's go and shoot at it or something like that. The thing is that not only is their technology far superior to ours and that would be ineffectual,
effectively, it's demonstrating the attitude of the human being for separation in the first place. And really what one has to do is really to understand the message that effectively one can translate one's biology actually back again. And in fact, when one looks inside the structures of cells, we can see various powerhouses. You know, I've been studying this. Really, there are ways, and using many references from other scientists as well, one can put together a really interesting story, really partly to show how this light, if you like, I mean, we're calling it light, this understanding, if you like, is shone really through the sort of dog legs of the atomic process, the machine part of the cell, to actually really sort of enliven it. And in fact, doing that, you see, this is the other continuum is really a peaceful process. Effectively, it doesn't work according to force. Now, one of the most interesting parts about something which doesn't work according to force is that it's essentially, in a way, a vacuum to force. And therefore, if you as you can see with the wind in the sky, you know, if you have a lower pressure in one place, the lower pressure doesn't pull air to it. The air, which is already more enforced, more pressed, the higher pressure basically presses back into that hole. And therefore, using sort of symmetrical shapes, etc., within the structure of atoms to really symmetrize things so that one can generate the most peaceful, if you like, or the least enforced paradigm, then effectively one can operate and force will then do the job for you. And if you therefore arrange it in such a way, you can get force itself to cancel itself out. And since an atom itself, you know, and especially hydrogen atoms, which are the very simplest atoms, really only have a small amount of force to them, one can effectively cancel that. And as soon as one cancels it, it's a bit like cooling it down to absolute zero. Once you cancel it, the thing really doesn't exist anymore. And then the crush of the universe for this that's coming in on this disappearing atom, if you like, generates light, essentially, and really you're effectively taking your body and you out of the whole system. And I think this is the message that Jesus really left us through this shroud, is that, you know, he said, you know, ye are gods and ye know it not. Really, it's effectively what I was talking about the optical fibers. You are one and the same thing, really. You are the original light, but from a viewpoint of looking at it from a separate point of view. So you can change your mind, this concept of metanoiete that Martin Luther really came up with as a translation in the Bible. Change your mind, and then you can effectively view everything from the point of view of everything. And effectively, you go back, and you change the whole atomic frame when you do that. And therefore, you become completely outside the touch of where atomic based intellect can actually reach, and then you're safe. And really, that's the sort of message. Perform acts in life which are additive to others, so that one can symmetrize one's own biology, both the atoms as well as the spirit, to be able to do that. And then you can drag the whole thing back and become irrelevant. These greys are effectively ineffectual. Then they can't touch you. And really, that's a sort of summary of what I think, you know, as a sort of conclusion to that story.
Okay. You know, somehow I can really relate to Nigel's statement that he's getting really good at asking questions. The answers are a little bit tough, because the more I've listened to you guys tonight, the more questions it actually creates. You know, things like, okay, where is the Shroud of Turin right now, today?
Well, can I tell you, I was invited after this, being part of the symposium, to Turin Cathedral, where the thing was exposed for a little while, so that this guy in a Pope mobile and a Cardinal Cadillacs or whatever these guys are, dressed up versions of the true version 2000 years ago. As you can see from that, I'm rather cynical about modern religious practices in terms of an organized church and all that kind of nonsense. My point is that every single one of us, Jesus, I believe, Christ was trying to say, and
the great teachers of other religious manifestations also tried to say that we were of a much larger size than we realize as human beings in our day-to-day kind of, you know, encounters with the day's own troubles, so to speak. So you see, Gia, the point I'm trying to make is we are something extraordinarily special. And in fact, the entire story I'm trying to make has great hope at the end of it through the affirmation provided by the Shroud of Turin that we are, in fact, something grander that has been reduced through, by default or by acquiescence, not knowing our propensities. They come and remind us, these great redeemers, and what do? We mangle them. We crucify them. We destroy them. Because there's a huge conspiracy, it seems, perhaps led by this huge and terrible intelligence that might be on our earth, that has its own kind of program to fulfill. And we, as natural human beings, ought to be able to say, oh, no, you don't. We have this natural power and propensity by thinking in ways of uniting, care, you call it love or caring or whatever, and that it's not something goody-goody, that it's a power to change the kind of natural drift through entropy of breaking up to the other, opposite way. And if we do that, we have a refuge, a wondrous universe that we can go to where everything goes together again, and there's an eternal scale of existence. In fact, if you look through the Bible and you study it very carefully, you will find there's only one thing that Jesus promised. He said, believe in me, and I will give you eternal life. And that means that he'll give you existence as you forever. And if you don't have existence, then everything is immaterial and useless. So therefore, you see, it's really an encouragement for us all to try to listen and to look outside the bounds of those things and people that come to lead us astray, so to speak. Now, I'm not a religious person, I repeat, and I don't want everyone to think I'm some kind of preacher or whatever. I just simply arrived at this conclusion by looking at everything through the looking glass, so to speak, of science. And it's through that that you really get a very sharp view. Ironically and paradoxically, it is through that you do this. And yet, most scientists are in the business of erasing a kind of God paradigm, if you see what I'm trying to say. I don't believe that there is a personalized, anthropomorphic individual up there, like the Sistine Chapel pointing at, you know, the finger pointing at Adam and all that kind of business, a man with a flowing beard. Yes, we can look at it like that, for our own convenience, if you like, but that principle of being all together in a singularity of complete knowledge together and complete beauty, understanding, and for instantness, no time, foreverness, is existent. That principle is there. I would call that point the Godhead, the God frame, or the God verse, if you like. And so as we have the universe and we're trapped in this dispersing mechanism, we also have its opposite. There's yin, there's a yang, there's a plus, there's a minus. And I think this is the great story that the great teachers were trying to actually convey to us till we got complicated along the way and perhaps mixed up with some extraordinary machine-type generic mechanism that we talk about as a UFO phenomenon and the greys.
Well, Nigel, I have to admit, we could probably go on another 2 hours very easily.
You bet.
But we have run out of time again. Nigel, John, I want to thank you both very much for joining us tonight and being such fantastic guests.
Thank you. You've given
us many questions.
Thank you, folks.
I've enjoyed the program with these two guys tonight, and I hope all of you have as well, and that you found it provided you with plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next Tuesday, and we'll bring you along for another episode of The Dawn of Shades as we embark on our Women in Ufology series, and it's sure to be another fascinating conversation with our guest as well. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott.
Time and good night.
I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.